story. As I was saying, we earlier, what we're doing is trying to go through the whole story of the Bible. And I hope that you're blessed, even half of what Paula and I are experiencing doing this, because it's giving us perspective, it's giving us a chance to look in depth. So you can read along with us. We basically have taken 4 weeks to get through the book of Genesis. That will end it, the end of Genesis. Now, we're not going to take 4 weeks on every book of the Bible. That would be about, what, 200 and almost 300 weeks. Genesis is so important. It's kind of the base of everything. If you put Revelations on the top, it's the peak. The base is Genesis. And if you look at Genesis, and this is actually, I put the numbers in some of the bigger letters so you could read it, but this is the format of a app that you can get on PC, Mac, iPad, or iPhone called Glow Bible, G-L-O. And the predominant part of it is free. You can buy in for more, which I did, but and so you click on it and you can get right to the Bible and you can get it in the translation you want. So I use the NIV, but this is Genesis. There's 50 chapters to Genesis. We have God's creation and man's fall, Noah and the flood, the Tower of Babel, the story of Abraham, the story of Isaac and Ishmael, the story of Jacob and Esau, Jacob's 12 sons, and then we have Joseph in Egypt. So we're going to be looking at from about chapter 12 on today. And we'll be looking at these four guys, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, who's up there and there, and Joseph. Joseph looks like a Pharaoh, but you'll find out why he's dressed that way if you stay awake for the whole sermon. So, one of the things, just to recap, and Paula had started out with this, is that probably the most distinctive thing as you come right out of the box is the fact that God is the one and the only one who can create something out of nothing. We were riding in this morning and Paula was saying she was studying the word let, L-E-T. Boy, that sounds pretty fine, but when God says let something happen, it comes into being. God speaks things that aren't into being. He gives us a power in a little bit different way to do the same thing, but more with our imaginations and being able to see that what he's doing. But God has the power to make things. Also, God is one who's reaching out to us constantly. We learn the word covenant. Sounds like a big fancy word. If you're a lawyer, you know the word covenant. It means an agreement. But covenant is the agreement that God makes with us, with different individuals, but usually with the intention of doing it for a people and eventually for the whole world. And so we saw two kinds of covenants, one in which God just does it. We don't have to do anything, he just does it, called a royal grant. And then the other is where God is sort of over us and he says, if you do this, I will do that. It's a conditional covenant. And so we know that sometimes God is just going to do things in our lives. And especially if he promises it. And we'll find that out as being a key piece of the story. God makes his first covenant with Adam and Eve. Tells them to be fruitful and multiply. But then something happens. Let me show you a little video clip.
And then he made us. to live in paradise. Until Adam and Eve disobeyed God and ate the forbidden fruit. And with one choice, they learned both good and evil.
And so, there's this one choice. And it looks like some small little thing, eating a piece of fruit. But it is God saying, you can do anything you want but this. And what do we do as people? Just what Adam and Eve does. You say, don't touch that. We go straight over to it. That's what we want. We think about it. It's like, don't think about pink elephants. And then you can't think of anything but pink. Well, but don't do this, God says. And that's what we want to do. Again, what he says to Adam and Eve, and then he says it again to Noah, and we'll hear it one more time, is he gives us promises, prosperity, which is actually gain, which is why we honor him when we have an offertory. He promises land to the people of Israel, and he promises fruitfulness. And in those days in particular, fruitfulness meant lots of kids. For some of you, that might be exciting. For others, I don't know, not as much. But it's what he does. He says, go and multiply and subdue the earth. Now, I also introduced at the very end of my sermon a new character, and his name was Abram. And
Ben.
Sorry. I can get it to go. This is Abram.
But before billions can believe in him, one man must hear God's voice and have the faith to follow.
Abraham, leave your home and go to the land I will give to you and your offspring. I will bless you. I will make you a father of many nations, with descendants as numerous as the stars.
So Abraham hears a call from God. Now you've got to imagine how difficult. It's not like he comes to church on Sunday and he hears people talking about God and God's, what does it sound like to hear God speak? Nobody is doing that. But here's a man that God calls out. See something in this just really normal man. As a matter of fact, when we see the four, what they call patriarchs, and we think patriarchs, we make statues of them and they look really holy, but they were just a ragtag group of men who were trying to live a life of God. And so, Abram is who we want to start with. And I'm going to hold on to this. That had a timer on it for some reason. I don't know why. Abram is, he's kind of upset because, you remember we said he wanted to be fruitful and multiply. His wife is not having any children. She's barren. And we're talking about someone who is now 60 years old. And so he's really forlorn about this. And this is what he says to God. Genesis 15. After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield and your great reward. But Abram said, O sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless? And the one who will inherit my estate is Eleazar of Damascus. It's one of his slaves. And Abram said, you have given me no children. So a servant in my household will be my heir. Then the word of the Lord came to him. This man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir. He took him outside and said, look up at the heavens and count the stars, if you can indeed count them. Then he said to them, so shall your offspring be. All of the stars in the sky, that's how much offspring Abram is promised. And he doesn't just go, oh, well, yeah, that sounds crazy. But he actually believes God. This new God that he's discovering, he believes. And it says that Abram believed the Lord and he credited it to him as righteousness. This particular scripture, which is Genesis 15:8, is quoted by many of the authors of books of the New Testament. And they say that there's a belief. He believed. Now, it's one thing to believe something that God says, believe that my hand is on this or whatever. But this is a promise of the future, and it looks like an absolutely impossible thing. How in the world is his wife at 60 years old going to have a baby? That just doesn't happen. And then, actually, if you read through further into chapter 15, God does mention to him in this dream something that won't involve him directly, but will involve the people of Israel. God says to him, and by the way, I'm going to send your descendants into a foreign land where they're going to be slaves for 400 years. Remember, we talked about God sits outside of time and he can see what's happening, what's going to happen in the future. And he's telling Abram that at 400 years, they're going to be stuck in Egypt. And we'll see how they get there. But God is telling them up front, this, good news, I'm going to give you children. Bad news, they're eventually going to become slaves for a time. And so Abram and Sarah talk, and they see it's impossible. Actually, at this point, he's 75 and she's 65. And I'm thinking, Paul and I have talked, and this gives us a chance we could still have children. There's hope. We're holding out for that. But
I'm not hoping.
No. But Sarah, I was. So thank you. Okay, this is impossible. God said he's going to do it, but it's impossible. So how could God do it? I know how God can do it, Sarai says. We can help him. I mean, how many times when God promises us something, do we help him? Okay, the help is kind of goofy, maybe, but we know this is impossible, and so God can't do it, we can't, well, we'll find a way to almost do it. So that's what they do. So Genesis 16 comes to us, and it says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. So she said to Abram, the Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her, which was actually a common kind of thing back in that society. Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar and she conceived. Now you got to realize, back in those days, they couldn't just go to the infertility clinic, and have in vitro fertilization or anything. I mean, none of that stuff existed. So they had this as an idea. She's going to help. Sarai's going to help. Well, may or may not be surprising, but after Hagar has a baby, it's a son, and they name him Ishmael, then Hagar starts getting resentful of Sarai. And Sarai gets more and more upset now, and she realizes she's really made a mistake. Eventually, we see she blames Abram, which most of us husbands could picture. Why did you do this? Well, you told me. No. And so we come to a point in the story, and these videos, by the way, I should mention, are from the movie The Bible that was shown on one of the network, History Channel, just a couple months ago. So what happens in this next scene, I've got two more videos for you, is that three men come, strangers, kind of mysterious strangers. And they come to speak to Abram, and then they also speak to Sarai. So let's watch this.
Abraham.
This is the Hollywood part.
Welcome, Lord. Please, join me. Bring water. Prepare food for our visitors.
Yes, Master.
Have you traveled far?
Yes, a long way. Abraham, where is your wife? In there.
Next year, Sarah will have a son. Why do you laugh?
Love.
You did. And when you have a son, you will name him Isaac, which means laughter.
Thank you for your hospitality. We must go.
Can I help you on your way? Where are you going?
Decide the fate of Sodom.
The three men there, it's interesting, many times theologians and pastors see them as being one of two things or both, actually, which is angels. You could tell that, I mean, Abram is a very important man. Whenever he goes somewhere, he goes with hundreds of people. I mean, his family is maidservants, workers, the whole. So when he's called to move somewhere, it's lots of people go with him. And so he's a very important man, but he sees right away that these men aren't normal, regular men. I don't know why this keeps flipping, but... And so he obviously has, I think it's actually a gift of what we would call Holy Spirit, of the gift of discernment of spirits. He discerns that these are men of spirit, they are angels. Now, one of them, many theologians believe, and you didn't show the third one, you saw the back of his head, they believe was actually Jesus visiting Abraham. You can argue about that with folks. I'm just throwing it out there as a common belief. That's where the judgment comes on. When he says Sodom, it's Sodom and Gomorrah that they move on to. Unfortunately, I think the movie breaks down a little bit at that point because one of the angels is Asian looking and he has two cross swords in his back and he looks like a ninja angel, and they actually get in some sword fights and stuff. So, but that's the Hollywood part. But I wanted to show this because this is the kind of outreach that God did in trying to reach out to Abram and tell him, I'm with you, I'm for you. And if Sarah doesn't believe, we're going to help. God often sends angels as messengers to tell us what he's doing. So they make promises to Abram and to Sarai. They said they're going to have a son, Isaac, and his name's going to mean laughter. It's obviously not a joke. What it is he's going to have joy in his life. That this is what's going to end. In fact, that's what happens. So a whole new chapter opens up as a new person, new patriarch is introduced, and his name is Isaac, or laughter. And when he is born and named Isaac, God renames Abram Abraham, which means father of many nations. And he renames Sarai Sarah. You can look in the Bible and see the name change. He often does that. Remember, he did Saul to Paul, Simon to Peter. He, in very big events, special times, he gives a new name. Now, Sarah, it means princess, and it's like there's a royal family here. Now that Sarah has a baby, the enmity between her and Hagar gets worse, because now you have the son, the oldest born, Ishmael, and you have the child of promise, which is Isaac. And so there is enmity, and finally Sarah, and I'm not sure how this is going to work. This is somehow, I don't know what, why the, there, okay, I'm back to where I should be. This is Sarah actually sending Hagar off. Now what in fact she does is to get Abraham to send her off. Now, it's not all bad because as he sends Hagar and Ishmael off into the wilderness, God promises that he will protect them. And they're out there and they've just run out of water, and God sends an angel to Hagar to minister to them, to give them water and food. And the angel says, Ishmael will be the father of a great nation. So God actually blesses, you might say, the losers in this. The people who aren't picked by God, he still blesses them. Now Ishmael, and I don't know if this is right or wrong for sure, but the Muslim culture claims to be descendants from him. So that is a great nation. And that does throw a different light on how we look at our Muslim brethren, yet then again, they're not still in the same line of promise. So now, all that has happened, they're gone. It goes many years later, and we have Isaac is a young boy. He's, I don't know, 10 or 12 years old. And I'm going to show you my last video in which God speaks to Abraham again, but this time it's a test. Chosen by God, like I told you, is a blessing and a test. So So it's not a cakewalk, ever. But it's worth it. So let's watch this.
Sacrifice. No. No. Have I not shown you enough faith? Isaac.
Eat up. When you have children of your own, you'll want them to grow up as big and Abraham. What's the matter?
God wants a sacrifice. My boy, come with me.
We have the firewood, but where's the lamb?
The Lord will provide a sacrifice, my son.
Did Abraham take a lamb?
No, mistress. Bring the wood. Isaac, you must trust in God.
Please.
Abraham! A sacrifice? Oh, my boy, my boy, my boy.
Abraham has passed the ultimate test. He will become the father of God's nation. Now it's up to Isaac. He will have a son called Jacob. God will rename him Israel. The promise of descendants as numerous as the stars is coming true. But famine forces the Israelites far from the promised land, to Egypt.
Which we'll get to in another week, but quite dramatic. There is so much prophetic in that story. That lamb has come and taken the place of his son, taken the place of the lamb is trapped, caught, like when we're caught in sin. And the lamb dies. And Jesus is called the Lamb of God, who dies for us. He's the one who sacrificed in our stead. Sarah dies at the age of 127. The numbers there are quite, if you look earlier, they're up in the 600s, 700s. But at the age of 127, and Abraham buys a piece of land in order to bury her there. That's the first piece of the land in Canaan that will come to Israel. It isn't secured and won't be secured for many hundreds of years after, but that's the first step in. It's the beginning of the fulfillment in which God said, I'm going to give you a land. Isaac inherits everything from Abraham, but before Abraham dies, he finds him a bride. Abraham's servant is sent to go find Abraham a bride. And the servant says, The servant says to Abraham, what if she won't come? What he had done is sent his servant back to Ur, back to where Abraham had originally come, to get his own people, to get a bride of his own people. And he said, well, look for a woman who will, when you're by the well, she will give you a drink of water and then water the camels also. And he finds such a woman. He stands by the well, and Rebekah comes along. And Rebekah is the granddaughter of Abraham's brother. If you think that's unusual, well, first of all, I remember the gene pool is pretty small back in those days. But also, it was very common for cousins and second cousins, or whatever this is, once removed, or to marry. As a matter of fact, Abraham is half-brother to Sarah. They had the same father, but different mothers. A couple times, Abraham tells people that this is his sister rather than his wife because she's so beautiful. Even at the age of 60, she's beautiful. Kind of like my wife. So. And but in fact, he isn't lying completely because she is his half-sister. So things were a little different back then. And so Rebecca actually comes back with the servant. And she marries Isaac. It's interesting, Isaac was 40 when he married Rebecca. And there's a number of similarities between Isaac and Rebecca and Abraham and Sarah. Rebecca was beautiful even at an older age, just like Sarah. Rebecca was barren. Isaac had to pray, and she didn't get pregnant until she was 60. Isaac moved his family to a new country because famine had hit. And he was afraid, too, that because his wife was so beautiful, so he told people that she was his sister also. So it's kind of like son, like father, like son, is to see that repeated over again. Well, finally, Rebecca gets pregnant, and she has twins. She's carrying twins in her womb. She doesn't know it. They didn't have ultrasound, but they were two boys. The first one born was Esau. Big, strong, strapping baby, already hairy all over the place and much bigger. And behind him came Jacob. And Jacob was actually hanging onto his heel, like he was trying to pull him back in so he could be the first one born. As infants. And so Esau is firstborn, so he should inherit the father's blessing, which means then he would be over all of the family. Well, Jacob comes along. Esau is a hunter. He is Isaac's favorite. Jacob is Rebekah's favorite, and Jacob is a rat. He's a scheming, conniving, control freak who's always trying to find ways to get his way. This is the patriarch Jacob. One day Esau comes in from hunting and he's really hungry and Jacob has just made a stew. And Esau says, "Give me some." And Jacob says, "You have to sell me your birthright to get a bowl of stew." And Esau, of course, at that point goes, "Yeah, anything, I'm hungry." So he's probably a teenage boy. Jacob is a rat. He takes advantage of it. When it's time for Esau to get his blessing, Isaac says to him, "Could you go off and hunt and get me some game? I love the kind of meat that you cook up." So Esau goes off obediently to do it, and while he's gone, Jacob gets the idea he's the one who's going to be, he's going to go get the blessing. Isaac is very old, he's dying, he can't see very well. He's not exactly sharp as a tack. So Rebecca thinks it's a great idea and helps him out. And she says, he's going to grab your arm and he's going to realize right away that you're not hairy like Esau. And so what she does is she wraps his arm, you can see it, in an animal skin that's hairy. And he actually goes in and Isaac does say, "Is that really you, Esau?" And then gives him the blessing. And he takes it away from his brother. And that puts them at odds for many years. Jacob goes off to another land to find himself a wife. And on the way to this new land, we start in Genesis 28, so we've progressed a ways here. It says, when he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. But he had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending in it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, God of your father Abraham and God of Isaac. I will give you your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring back to this land. I will not leave you until you have done what I have promised to you. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Many people call this Jacob's ladder. He named the place Bethel, which is a place of God. Jacob gets to the land. He meets Laban, who has a beautiful daughter, Rachel. And he's really falls in love, smitten right away. So he finds that he has to work 7 years to get Rachel so that he can marry her. He has to work for Laban. After 7 years, they have a big wedding feast. And they have the wedding. The bride has a veil. And when he gets into the tent with his new bride, he finds out it's not Rachel. It's Leah, her older sister. And he comes back out and says to Laban, I said I was going to marry Rachel. And he said, the oldest sister has to be married first. So he has to go through another 7 years. So the rat gets somewhat of his own medicine in this way. And so he's really in love with Rachel. You can see some contention there. He heads back home, sort of wore out his welcome, as rats tend to do when they're with family. And so he returns to his homeland. And while he's there, he falls asleep again. And in this, he has a dream in which he's wrestling with an angel. And he actually gets his hip thrown out. But he's wrestling and he's asking God for his blessing. And what he's asking for is blessing, not one that he stole from his brother, but his own real blessing. And God is so impressed that he does it. But then he has to face Esau. And Esau is the big, strong brother who's probably going to beat the crap out of him. So he's pretty scared. But what's really interesting and kind of cool is that when Esau sees him, he comes running to him and hugs him. Now, that's just not something the older brother does to the younger brother, let alone what had happened between them. And so it's a blessing. And it shows the power of being brothers. Well, as it seems to fit the storyline, Rachel is barren. And Leah has lots of kids. And then she gives him one of her maidservants also to have children. And at this point, Jacob decides he's going to try and make as many stars in the sky as he can. So he's going, having all kinds of children. And finally, at an old age, Rachel has Joseph. And then a second child, Benjamin. And Joseph is the last chapter in our genealogy in Genesis. Joseph is, of course, the favorite because Rachel was the favorite. And Jacob treats him better, buys him you probably heard the Broadway movie, The Coat of Joseph and the Coat of Many Colors. He's showing off. He has a dream in which he tells his brothers, I dreamt that we were all shucks or stacks or whatever. And mine was in the center and you were all bowing down to me, which actually didn't go over very well with his brothers. So one day his brothers take him out and throw him in a well. And he's down in the well wanting to get out, and a caravan comes through and they sell their brother to the caravan into slavery. The caravan's heading to Egypt. They come back and they tell Jacob, a wild animal ate him. He's gone, he's dead. And Jacob, of course, mourns for a long time. Joseph ends up in Egypt. And, I have a picture of them throwing him in the well, too. So Joseph ends up in Egypt. But Joseph has got the same issue that all the other stories seem to have, which is brothers. There's a contention of brothers to brothers. There's a way in which there's always a battle. There's a band of brothers. And I have to tell you that for this, it was a real touching time for me reading this. I had a brother. He was 13 months younger than me. And he lived 2 weeks. And as I read this, I think, what would be the parallel universe of my brother having lived instead? How different my life would have been. But that wasn't to be. Joseph is in Egypt. God blesses everything he does, and he actually rises up to quite fame. And he's working for a man there, a master by the name of Potiphar. Well, Potiphar's wife gets really interested in Joseph. And she sort of comes on to him. And he said, he's holding her off and going, no. So she tells Potiphar that he advanced on her. And he gets thrown in prison, and he's in there for years. And one day, he's there, and in the prison is thrown a baker and a food taster of the pharaohs. And Joseph is given an interpretation of a dream that really saves them, and they get out of jail. And as they're leaving to get out of jail, he says, "Don't forget me." And they do. And they leave him there for another couple years. And as the time goes by, one day the Pharaoh says, "I had this dream and I don't know what it means." And these two guys go, "Hey, wait, there's a guy in prison who interprets dreams." So Pharaoh brings him up, says, "I hear you interpret dreams." And of course he says, "Well, God does, but I get the interpretation." He says, "I have a dream of 7 fat cows. And then it comes along 7 skinny cows, and they eat the fat cows." And so Joseph tells him that there's going to be 7 years of plenty, and then there'll be a famine for 7 years, and that the famine will eat up all the plenty that came from the first 7 years. And so he says, "So you need to take a fifth of everything that happens in the first 7 years and set it aside." And the Pharaoh believes him and is so excited, he makes him number 2 in charge above everyone. And it comes to 7 years of abundance, and then they're into the 7 years of famine, and everyone is starving except Egypt. Egypt's got grain. And so Jacob sends his sons to Egypt to buy some grain. And they show up before Joseph. And they don't recognize who Joseph is. This has been many years later. And Joseph sort of gives him a hard time and says, is your father still alive? Is your brother still alive? Do you have any other brothers? And he tells him to bring them. And so we get to the story where they're before Joseph, and Joseph reveals himself to them. Joseph reveals himself to them. And they are just shocked, but they're also scared to death, because they think they're in big trouble. I mean, look what they did to him. And comes one of the best scriptures in the Bible, I think. As Joseph says to them, "But Joseph said to them, 'Don't be afraid. Am I in a place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives, including those in Israel. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. That's where Genesis ends. And it's a matter of how God has blessed them from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Joseph. And even when things are bad, when things are terrible, God makes it for good. I want to end with just an observation. A lot of people say, well, Israel was obedient to God. That's why they got so blessed by God. That's kind of backwards. It's the other way around. I've heard a professor quote this. He says, God didn't bless the people of Israel because they were obedient. They were obedient because God blessed them. Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited to him his righteousness. Remember, we heard that. God's people were and are a ragtag group, slightly irregular people. But God puts us in a circle of grace where we can obey him. There is no relationship without a response. It's a matter of God is giving us a circle of grace, each and one, every one of us, right now. There is no relationship. If you ever tried to date somebody and they weren't interested in you, there's no relationship. No response or bad response doesn't work. So God is giving us a circle of grace, an invitation, a promise, many promises. And he says, I want to offer that to you. And I think right now that's what he's doing with each and every one of us. He's offering it and he's saying, what I'm looking from you is what you have to do is respond. Respond to me. I'm giving you this grace, this opportunity. And all you have to do is believe and then I will reckon it righteousness to you. That's what he's calling us to.